from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a bridge scandal blows up on Chris Christie. Former Defense Secretary Bob Gates tells all, and we can't stop saying polar vortex. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie apologized yesterday for days of epic traffic jams that look like engineered political payback, retribution.
I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates goes after the president on Afghanistan and Joe Biden, saying the VP's been wrong on more or less everything for decades. Jay Carney pushed back on that from the White House.
As a senator and as a vice president, Joe Biden has been one of the leading statesmen of his time, and he has been an excellent counselor and advisor to the president.
Deep Arctic cold grabs a huge portion of the country, and it came with a name. Here's Washington, D.C. resident India Owen.
Polar vortex. I feel better knowing the name of it, I think. I'm not sure. That might make it worse. Polar vortex sounds pretty scary.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Chuck Babington of the Associated Press, Margaret Brennan of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me now from Washington is Charles Babington, covers Congress and politics for the Associated Press. Chuck Babington, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, Margaret Brennan is here. She covers the State Department for CBS News. Margaret, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chuck, and Margaret.
All right, Chris Christie, big in the news this week. And, it all goes back to Fort Lee, New Jersey, just across the river from Manhattan, the GW Bridge. Fort Lee sits right there. Epic traffic jams back at the beginning of school. Talking Wednesday to CNN's Wolf Blitzer, here was Mark Sokolich, the mayor of Fort Lee, slamming what has now been revealed as an act of political retribution by top aides to Governor Chris Christie, the closing of lanes leading from his town to the GW Bridge in September.
It's not even remotely acceptable to do what you did. It is the lowest, most venomous form of political retaliation. And this in a time when New Jersey needs this like we need a hole in the head. We've now ensured that we're going to remain the butt of every political joke for the next 20 years on political misconduct.
The emails that came out this week from a top Chris Christie aide. Well, here's one from Bridget Kelly. Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, she wrote. And she got them. Here was Chris Christie yesterday talking about firing her. Said she lied to him.
This morning, I've terminated the employment of Bridget Kelly, effective immediately. I've terminated her employment because she lied to me. There's no justification for that behavior.
Epic two-hour press conference yesterday by Chris Christie, Charles Babington. Where does this leave Chris Christie? How big the stakes here? Is he slipping this noose?
The stakes are definitely big because he clearly wants to run for president. He did about as well as he could have, given the circumstances, I think, yesterday. He showed contrition. He did not lose his temper. He wore the reporters down, taking their questions, suggesting he has nothing to hide. Clearly, he's not completely out of the woods. There's going to be all kinds of new discovery and documents that the Democrats in the legislature will demand. He gave every sign that he does not believe there's anything else out there, but there are things he may not be able to control, and I think that's going to be the nervousness for his office for some time to come.
Margaret Brennan, here's an email from one of our listeners saying that they think the story's worth the press's attention, but why so much ferocity and skepticism and intensity, Pete asks, on this compared to, he says, the IRS scandal, Benghazi scandal. Do you see the press going bigger on this than they went on Benghazi or IRS? Is the attention appropriate to the incident, Margaret?
Listen, the U.S. press loves talking about itself and loves talking about what's happening here at home because there are interesting characters to focus on here. Chris Christie remains this darling in the political world with these speculations about whether or not he'd run for president or what he'd do next. So it's really almost more about the personality than it is about the actual traffic jam on the GW. Having worked in Fort Lee for a few years at the beginning of my career when I was at CNBC, I can tell you, though, that the traffic is painful. I feel badly for the people who suffered there, and certainly a governor governor punishing his own state is something that deserves some conversation. But from my point of view, I'm focused more on what's happening overseas than on that particular bridge.
Jack, at the other end of the spectrum, in this country, we've got listeners saying, hey, charge those Christie aides with domestic terrorism. If it was Al-Qaeda starting traffic and people dying in ambulances, whatever it was, you'd do that. What do you see as the legacy here for Chris Christie out of all this hullabaloo this week, Jack?
Well, you know, I think that it's yet to be written. As Chuck said, the discovery is going to go on. There were, you know, hundreds of pages of redacted material. Why was it redacted? We don't know. What are we going to find out from the discovery? We don't know. You have to be skeptical, however. The governor, you know, says, I am not a bully. The record is replete with evidence that, in fact, he is a bully. On December 24th, the Times ran a long piece, Stories Add Up as Bully Image Trails Christie. They point to a former governor who was stripped of his police security at a public event because he crossed Christie. A Rutgers professor who lost financing for a program because he had said something Christie didn't like. A state senator whose judgeship suddenly stalled because he got foul of Christie, and on and on and on. And, you know, the governor yesterday did not take responsibility for the culture of sort of, you know, revenge that he had inculcated through these, you know, behaviors. And in this respect, he reminded me a little bit of Henry II, you know, talking about Becket. He said of Thomas of Becket, who will not rid me of this troublesome priest? I mean, you know, did the people around Christie and very close to him get the message from the way he played hardball that this was perfect? You know, maybe this was a jot more than he usually did, but quite in line with his usual M.O. We don't know, and all of these questions are out there and will come back.
Chuck, I want to bring that to you. Here's Christie himself on that question yesterday, asked at the press conference, are you a bully?
I am who I am, but I am not a bully. And what I will tell you is that the folks who have worked with me over a long period of time would, I believe, tell you that I'm tough. But I've shown over the last 4 years in the tone that we've set here that I'm willing to compromise.
So the question, Chuck, that lingers out there still, you know, is this is a very appealing man. All the polls show that. But is he in some way Tony Soprano in a politician's suit? I mean, this was an old high school friend of his at the Port Authority, top members of his political staff, Bridget Ann Kelly, deputy chief of staff. These were not strangers to him. Jack says skepticism about whether he really didn't know, or even if he didn't, a culture around him that green-lighted.
Even if no more smoking guns come out, the governor is still going to have to explain why he had very high-ranking aides who had been with him a long time who clearly thought this was acceptable or appropriate behavior. You know, if we elect a president, that president is going to appoint all kinds of extremely important assistants and aides to run the country, and you want someone with good judgment. A Republican senator, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, talked about this yesterday, and I'll quote here. He said, I just don't see how people that close to him could have felt comfortable enough to do this if they thought their boss wasn't of this mindset. Isn't that just common sense? Close quote. That's the type of question that's going to be asked again. Was he just completely duped by these high-ranking aides who were, you know, working right next to him?
We'll look at some of these big issues abroad, but this is right on our doorstep. Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina, is calling on. Hi, Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment that, first of all, Christie made this all about himself and did not address the awful consequences to the people. First responders couldn't get through. And I heard that a little girl went missing and they couldn't go look for her because of this. And the other thing is the earlier comment that this is no big deal compared to some other things going on.
Benghazi, IRS, you name it, yeah.
The IRS, nobody's life was put at risk by the IRS. So I think we need to address this as the very serious thing that it really was.
Brenda, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, clearly Democrats happy to focus on this, but not only Democrats. Chris Christie has a lot of contenders in the GOP on the presidential aspiration front who may be taking some pleasure in his discomfort this week, Jack.
Yes, you know, he's sort of a man on an island. I mean, the silence from GOP ranks is really quite striking. You know, he's got competitors with him. I mean, Rand Paul took a gentle shot at him. But I think just in general, first of all, he did embrace President Obama, and that really goes down hard.
Literally hugged him in New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy.
Right. And, you know, he's accepted the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare and so on. And at the Republican convention, you know, we remember Clint Eastwood's imaginary conversation. Mm. But what about Chris Christie's, you know, speech nominating Romney that barely mentioned Romney? It just went on and on about how great Chris Christie was. So there's a lot of reasons out there that Republicans, even though they see that he's a potentially powerful candidate, there's a lot of resentment.
Well, maybe so, but also a lot of capacity there in that man. Those 2 hours yesterday were epic, and he knows how to connect. Margaret Brennan, let's go to those al-Qaeda flags fluttering over Fallujah, Ramadi, beyond, inside Iraq, all these years after American soldiers fought and died there, a couple of 3 years after American soldiers left there, while on the other side of the border in Syria, you've got rebels fighting against al-Qaeda. What's going on in this region, Margaret?
Well, right now what you're seeing is the breakdown of the border between Iraq and Syria. And a large part of that has to do with this massive magnet in Syria that's drawing in all these foreign fighters to the power vacuum and to the war that's underway there. So what that's doing is basically allowing al-Qaeda to establish a foothold that's launching then attacks well into Iraqi territory that just back in 2009 had been relatively stable when the U.S. decided to draw down. President Obama was elected on this platform of ending the war in Iraq, ending the war in Afghanistan. But what we're seeing in these past 2 years is that he's in some ways presiding over the expansion of a regional war with al-Qaeda, threatening a lot of these U.S. allies or strategic allies, and that now is threatening to draw in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. remains committed to this idea of not bringing U.S. troops into the picture, but what we're seeing is that it's drawing in U.S. diplomats, it's drawing in U.S. funding, it's drawing in U.S. interests, and it really remains to be seen whether there are other dominoes to fall in the region. And that right now is what Iraq's Prime Minister Maliki is afraid of. He's afraid that his country is going to fall to al-Qaeda, which has established a real foothold right across that border in Syria.
And now in Fallujah itself, a big question there about Iraq, but also about the U.S. Here was John Kerry, Secretary of State, on Sunday, saying that he'd do everything possible to help the Iraqi government, but no boots on the ground.
We're not contemplating putting boots on the ground. This is their fight. But we're going to help them in their fight. This is a fight that is bigger than just Iraq.
So you've got regional implications, but the politics came right home. Here was Lindsey Graham of South Carolina on Tuesday talking with Greta Van Susteren on Fox News.
We won the war and lost the peace. I blame Obama and Biden for not listening to their commanders, rejecting some advice. And Bob Gates talks about that in his book, how military commanders were overruled by the political people in the White House. Now you see al-Qaeda on the rise.
Chuck Babington, is there real heat about this in Washington? There's real heat in the region. Things are boiling there. Does it seem distant these days from Washington?
It was a big topic yesterday in Washington. We just heard from Lindsey Graham on Tuesday. Yesterday, he and John McCain spoke from the Senate floor, making those very types of criticisms about the president's policy in Iraq. And then on the House side, House Speaker John Boehner, who generally is involved more with domestic issues than foreign issues, at his weekly press conference, he took a hard shot at the president, saying that he hasn't done enough to secure, the peace in Anbar province, said that he should have done more to keep a military presence there, although neither Boehner nor any of these other critics are recommending that we send new troops back into Iraq.
Let's go to Ronaldo in Beloit, Wisconsin. Ronaldo, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a vet of Iraq. What this showing is that those people in that part of the world only understand one thing, that's power. And this president just doesn't show it. All during the election, we heard about how al-Qaeda was on its heels. I wish somebody would come out in the press and finally admit to it that it's not on its heels. This thing is out of control over there in the Middle East. Until he starts showing power and as a leader, this is not going to. This is going to continue to happen.
Ronaldo, I appreciate your call. There is no question. President Obama made much of al-Qaeda being way back on its heels. Of course, Osama bin Laden was dead. That was a centerpiece of the campaign. Jack Beatty, what about it? There's a veteran saying they only understand power. There's been a lot written this week saying this is all a result of a vacuum left by the United States. On the other hand, you look at the polls, very few Americans want to be anywhere near there with boots on the ground.
Yes, to Ronaldo's point, yesterday James Comey, the new director of the FBI, was quoted as saying that he used the word metastasizing, that al-Qaeda is metastasizing in that part of the world. He made a distinction. He said, al-Qaeda central in Pakistan, Afghanistan, that's relatively contained, but metastasizing in the Arabian Peninsula. So that's clearly going on. You know, this question about the vacuum. It assumes, first of all, that if we had left troops there, that somehow that would have prevented this sort of tragic, spiral of events. We didn't have any choice about whether we were going to leave troops there. According to reporting by Dexter Filkins in The New Yorker, the Shiite politicians of Iraq rejected our status of forces agreement in 2011. Why? Because Tehran told them to. And Tehran is calling the shots there. They're a government in Iraq that's friendly to them. Iraq is a land bridge and an air bridge to Syria for them. You know, the vacuum was really created by our invasion. We stopped these balances of power, Saddam versus Iran, Shia versus Sunni. Those balances were all upset. And now this tragic, tragic sequel is just playing out.
We'll see more talk about vacuum there. I wonder about balances even now, Margaret. Here's a little tape earlier this week. This is one moderate Syrian rebel in the northern rebel-held, one of the northern rebel-held towns, talking with Ivan Watson of CNN about what emerged vividly this week with big death tolls, infighting among the anti-government groups. Moderate, sort of domestic rebels there against al-Qaeda that's come to town. Here he is saying that al-Qaeda, well, he speaks for himself. Here's the moderate voice.
They're worse than Bashar al-Assad's regime, this rebel says. They banned smoking cigarettes. And if my wife went out showing even an inch of skin, they would arrest her.
So is this self-staunching, Margaret? Do local people stand up and say, no, we don't want al-Qaeda? And that's where the line gets drawn.
Yes, and you're seeing that. I mean, but if you talk to Syrian rebels who are the moderates, who are receiving some Western support, even some of those rebels who are Islamists, but they don't ally themselves with al-Qaeda, they are battling back against these al-Qaeda-linked groups because the Syrian ones often say, the Islamic Front among them, we want to protect our own backyard and build up our own state. And these foreign fighters in from Libya, Iraq, around the world, don't have the same interest that we have in our own backyard. But the bottom line is, as anyone knows, reality is going to be decided on the battlefield. And if the strongest fighters are coming in from overseas with al-Qaeda funding, al-Qaeda arms, that's going to influence things more than people just saying, hey, that's not exactly what we want in our backyard at this immediate moment. It is not necessarily fair in the U.S. press, and we often get stuck here in talking about Iraq and Syria in these terms of there's either an invasion or there's nothing that can be done. And there's a lot in between that is being done by U.S. policymakers on the diplomatic front to try to build up moderates. They're trying to, help Maliki's government in Iraq. But
also sending weaponry.
Well, yes, that's been very limited, and the rebels will tell you that in Syria.
In Iraq, we've got drones going in there right this week, helicopters coming in from Russia. I don't know about the U.S.
Well, you are correct. I mean, the U.S. is expanding, millions of dollars just in the past few weeks in particularly these drones you mentioned. They'll be going in the next weeks, but that's financing. That's giving more weapons to the government to fight rebels. That's really hard to do overnight after there's no air force left in Iraq. We are asking the Iraqi government to force Iran to bring down their planes so that we can prevent them from shipping arms to the Syrian government. The Iraqi government will turn to the U.S. as they did in March when I was there with Secretary Kerry in Baghdad and say, well, that's nice you're asking us to do that, but we don't have any ability. We don't have an air force.
Yep.
How do we force planes to land? So there's a lot of nuance that's left out of this storytelling, unfortunately. But the bottom line is Al-Qaeda is ascendant in Iraq right now, and violence is at these 2007 levels. And that is bringing in the entire region into a spreading war.
Maybe a lot of nuance, but that's a big statement all in itself. Roger in Florence, South Carolina. What do you think, Roger?
Well, I think it's ridiculous that a current administration is being blamed for a war that's been going on for 1,700 years. But we are seeing one thing. Iraq did not turn into another Vietnam because Vietnam's making circuit boards and T-shirts. What we have created is the next manufacturing center of every terrorist that we're going to have to deal with for the next 1,700 years.
Roger, it sounds like you should have a blog. You have a way with words. We'll see. 1,700 words is a long time. I hope not. Harry in Chester, Vermont. Harry, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a currency and oil trader in Manhattan. And let me just say this. The bottom line, I never hear the word, except in certain circles. The bottom line is oil, O-I-L. Iraq has 150 billion barrels of oil. They'll be producing 4 million barrels of oil this year. And if that isn't an interest of the United States, I heard Ray Ordinerno said we would have to go in if Al-Qaeda took over or attempted to take over the government of Iraq. If the security forces fail, we will have to go in.
So the real politics still circles around that oil. You think, hey, Harry, you're a trader. What about all the talk about, well, we're energy independent now in this country. Never mind.
Yeah, but you can't afford to let Al-Qaeda to get this oil. We'll be fighting there for hundreds of years if you ever do.
Wow. Charles, what do you say?
Wow. I cover Congress. I don't hear this debate talked about very much in the context of oil, whether that's a legitimate underlying reason or not. It is talked about in terms of what Margaret was talking about. Did this administration do enough to help the Iraqi government? That sort of thing. So it's very much in terms of funding for the Pentagon and in terms of policy. I got to say, I don't hear the oil argument come up very much.
Though, as Tom Friedman often argues, you've got a lot of oil already funding these fights out of the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Iran itself, oil and oil dollars behind a lot of this. Let's turn to another line of criticism, if we may. We've got former Defense Secretary Robert Gates with a big new book out this week. He's just begun talking about it, but people have been reading a lot. And the first headline that comes out, Margaret, is Gates slams Obama on Afghanistan. What's the heart of the critique?
Well, the former defense secretary covered a few different areas on which he also did agree with the president. So it wasn't just completely a slam job here, but he did raise some criticisms that you do hear privately from folks over at the Pentagon, particularly in regard to there not being a clear dedication to a long-term goal in Afghanistan, that there was fundamentally this philosophical questioning of what's the ultimate goal here, and not an articulation of exactly how to execute what that end goal is going to be. Simply put, that's what you continue to hear over at the Pentagon right now, as there's this standoff with the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who still hasn't signed off on that bilateral security agreement. For anyone who's covered what happened in Iraq, you're going to have flashbacks there, because if you do see a full withdrawal, full drawdown, something that the U.S. military leaders have consistently advised against, but the White House has threatened, you potentially risk all of what the U.S. Fought for over the past 13 years there and the empowerment of some of the Afghan people there. I mean, you just saw the intelligence community last week warn that you could have all the gains that were established in the past few years wiped out in the next three if you don't see a real substantial military presence remain there. And for President Obama, so much of his presidency has been, and philosophy has been, around ending the war. And from the military, you hear okay, let's end the war, but let's lay out this strategy. And there's been this frequent criticism that from the White House, the direction has not been clear.
Jack, the first word out of this book, I think the Washington Post more or less had it, that President Obama never himself really believed in his own surge in Afghanistan. What about that characterization of Gates' report?
Well, Steve Inskeep this morning spoke to that. He interviewed Secretary Gates. The interview will be run on Monday's morning edition. He gave a peek of it right to that point. He said that Gates said, no, I didn't mean that Obama was cynically going through the motions to fob off the military, to buy off the military with this escalation and didn't believe in his surge. What I meant was, he lost faith in it as it proceeded. He doubted that it would succeed. He thought the military had misrepresented what it could achieve. That's a very different spin than the initial one the Post gave, which was, you know, he was a sort of Chicago politician buying off the military with an escalation and didn't believe in it at all.
Let's go to Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just confused. I'm hearing everyone say today that they feel like, I heard a caller on your show earlier say that until the president starts showing some power over there.
Yeah.
And I'm confused by this because I'm a soldier, and I've got to ask, how much more power can you possibly show?
Did you serve in Iraq, Paul?
Yes, I did. And it was frustrating seeing hundreds of thousands of troops over there. We were over there. We had power. We tried very hard. We were doing it every day. It's very easy to kill a lot of something. It's very hard to kill all of something.
That's
what people don't quite get.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, how much power do you want to demonstrate? There was certainly a lot. I appreciate that, Paul. Let us just hold that question and go to Joe in Boston. Joe, quick, you're on the air.
How's it going, Tom?
Okay, our time is short before the break. Joe, what do you think?
I just think that, you know, with the Iran nuclear deal issue coming up and they're starting to squabble about enrichment issues, I can't think of a better time to stop bickering about that and work together on a huge security concern for both countries, which is Fallujah and the takeover by Al-Qaeda in the city.
So time to sit down with Iran and talk about this. But then, if we do, you're in the soup with Saudi Arabia, who's very nervous about the U.S. making a big deal with Iran. Has boots on the ground of their own, in a sense, here now, Margaret, don't they?
It's interesting, actually. Sure, but it's interesting to hear the question raised about Iran, because what you hear from U.S. policymakers right now is that they're in some ways heartened that they're not seeing Shiite militias rage ahead with violence in a way they did back in 2007. Mm-hmm. Right now, you are seeing a lot of them who take marching orders from Iran holding back relatively. So it's interesting to see Iran wants stability there right now.
Margaret Brennan with CBS News, Chuck Babington with the AP, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a loopy Dennis Rodman making headlines from North Korea. Here's Conan O'Brien's take.
During a satellite interview from North Korea, Dennis Rodman started screaming at a CNN reporter. Yeah. And there was an awkward moment when Kim Jong-un said, "My God, this guy is a lunatic."
On Wednesday, former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords went skydiving on the third anniversary of the Tucson shooting that left her critically wounded. In a joint interview with her husband, Mark Kelly, Giffords talked about jumping from a plane.
Wonderful sky, gorgeous mountain, blue skies. I like it a lot.
I like it
a lot.
A lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
Was it peaceful?
Peaceful, so peaceful.
And Black Power poet and political activist Amira Baraka died yesterday at 79. Here he is reading from his controversial poem, Somebody Blew Up America, in 2009 in Troy, New York.
Who the biggest terrorists? Who changed the Bible? Who kill the most people? Who do the most evil? Who don't worry about survival? Who have the colonies? Who stole the most land? Who rule the world? Who say they good but only do evil?
Amira Baraka, gone at 79. We're looking at a week in the news. Chris Christie's Bridgegate, Bob Gates' big book, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Polar Vortex. Let's go to Michigan. Been cold there. Nona from Toivola, Michigan. You're on the air, Nona.
Well,
Thanks. Are you warm now?
I'm a little warmer than we were, but it's been old-time cold this week, down in the teens and below, down zero and below.
I know, it's above zero now. But the oddest thing that I heard, you know, thought around our little area, you know, this is the big tourist section up here in the
Upper Peninsula. Yes.
And on Monday and Tuesday, they shut down the ski hill. The ski hill was closed because it was so cold.
Too cold for winter sports. Pipes bursting all over. Plumbers busy as can be.
I think our electric bill is going to be way up because we've had our faucets dripping in our toilet. You know, we got a stick in the toilet to keep that running.
Hey, that seems the least of it this week. Nona, in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, stay warm there. I mean, the interesting thing has been to look at the weather maps, Jack, all the way down into the south where this just doesn't happen. Nashville and beyond, cold, cold, cold. And Margaret in Washington, D.C., where people freak out over snow and cold. You've had your share, too.
They do. I'm a New England native, so I always sort of chuckle down here in D.C. Because you get a reminder we are south of the Mason-Dixon line when a few flakes fall or when it gets a little chilly. But I actually was lucky this week. I just got back from Thailand, where it was in the 90s.
Oh, we have no sympathy for you then.
I know. I carried home some of the warmth, yeah, I think.
Good for you. Let's go to Mike in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What's on your mind this week?
Well, this business with gay marriage. I feel like ever since everybody started jumping out of the closet, we're having to change the rule book to suit them. I mean, I myself am heterosexual, but I don't run up and down the sidewalk going, hey, you know, I'm a heterosexual. Make special rules for me. Change the laws to suit me because I don't like how you do.
Well, I think part of what some are saying, Mike, is, well, we don't want special rules. We want the same rules as you, sir. What about that view?
I beg your pardon? They want the same rules that I have?
Yeah.
That's fine. If you want to do what you want to do in the bedroom, they're still not the majority. The majority of people out here are heterosexual, and the majority rules. Isn't that the way of it?
Well, that is true with individual rights, but I've definitely got the perspective, Mike, and I appreciate your call. Chuck Babington, this was the Utah issue this week, where the judge ruled a gay marriage. Here we go, and what in no time at all, you had 900 or 1,000 gay marriages there. The state appealing that, and Sonia Sotomayor on the Supreme Court, where each justice has a region that they pay attention to, saying, "Wait a minute, that's now stopped." Chuck, where does that go?
What's going on in Utah and Mike's call are good reminders that, in many ways, we think gay rights, gay marriage, it's almost done, that the change in national sentiment has changed so dramatically that it's clear where this issue is going. But, Tom, in politics, it's a reminder that in Republican circles, and especially in Republican primaries for president, this is still a salient and difficult issue, and it's going to be hard for not impossible, but difficult for a Republican to get the presidential nominee without going against what is really what appears to be the national sentiment on this. So obviously that's going to cause him or her a problem once the nomination is secured and you get to the general election. This is an issue that, as political reporters, we have to keep an eye on in that context of the Republican activist voters who dominate Republican primaries.
That wave of gay marriage green lights hitting a hiccup now in Utah. We'll see where that goes. Another kind of culture line right there in Texas this week. There was a remarkable story. Brain dead 33-year-old pregnant woman. And the state came in. It turns out she was brain dead, but 14 weeks pregnant. Her wish was not to be kept alive. Her family's wishes for her not to be kept alive. She is being kept alive because of the fetus. She is to be kept alive, says the state, to term against her wishes. Here's her mother, Lynn Machado, talking with CBS News on Monday.
I break down and I cry because I know in my heart my daughter's gone. But to see her shell there and being forced to be alive, it's hard to see her when we feel like we're caught in this limbo.
Margaret Brennan, here's a pretty big state intervention. I mean, you talk rights of the unborn, but what about the rights of this woman and the woman's health perspective here?
Listen, this is a heartbreaking story, and it's hard not to react on an emotional level when you hear the pain in a mom's voice like that. But, you know, fundamentally, that these debates over when life begins, I think, are going to haunt us for years to come. And it's going to continue in terms of deciding when life ends as well. You know, when consciousness goes, does that mean the person has it as well? It's a really tough issue.
Speaking of tough issues, poverty big in the news this week. We've heard more tape of LBJ than I've heard in many a year. 50th anniversary of the State of the Union address, his first that he gave back in 1964, where he declared war on poverty. We had President Obama and Marco Rubio both talking about poverty this week, how to address it. This was the president yesterday at the White House announcing a plan to set up what he calls promise zones in 5 hard-hit communities across the country.
We call these communities promise zones. They're neighborhoods where we will help local efforts to meet one national goal, that a child's course in life should be determined not by the zip code she's born in, but by the strength of her work ethic and the scope of her dreams.
Promise zones. We'll look at that. A day earlier, Marco Rubio, with his own presidential ambitions, gave a speech laying out his anti-poverty agenda.
What I am proposing today is the most fundamental change to how the federal government fights poverty and encourages upward mobility since President Johnson first conceived the war on poverty 50 years ago today. I am proposing that we turn over Washington's anti-poverty programs and the trillions that are spent on them to the states. Our anti-poverty program should be replaced with a revenue-neutral flex fund. We would streamline most of our existing federal anti-poverty funding into a single agency.
Jack Beatty, what do you see emerging in this poverty debate? There is talk in the Republican Party about inequality for the first time in a long time. Is it leading to new solutions from the GOP? Is Marco Rubio onto new terrain here or not, Jack?
Well, he is and he isn't. He isn't in that this idea of, you know, block granting to the states is an old Republican idea. Paul Ryan has identified with it in terms of Medicaid, and that's been criticized as a way of cutting Medicaid and therefore harming the poor. But on the other hand, there's some ideas in here. I can imagine, well, economists like Larry Summers have talked about federal wage enhancement for qualifying low-wage jobs. In other words, you hire somebody who's unemployed or someone who you hire someone for a low wage, the federal government will help pay for a higher wage than the market would bear. That's an idea that would pay some serious look. You can't also deny that the GOP just recently, it looks more, the Democrats say, that they have a war on the poor rather than on poverty. I mean, they're against raising the minimum wage, against extending most of them unemployment benefits, emergency benefits. They're against the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. They want to tremendously cut $40 billion out of food stamps. Just this week, they voted against fuel assistance increases up here in the Northeast. So, you know, the debate is joined, and I think finally, of course, it comes back to the Bible, by their fruits ye shall know them.
Chuck Babington, we saw this kind of ideological split playing out in the unemployment benefits extension debate this week in the U.S. Senate. What about approaches to poverty, approaches to the unemployed right now, Chuck?
It's an issue, Tom, that we're going to see increasingly in the coming months. It's going to play out in sort of two tracks. One is poverty, and talked about in many of the traditional ways going back to LBJ 50 years ago, but also watch for a lot of talk about income inequality, and that gets you more into the middle classes and the whole question of has the middle class been left behind? And there's lots of evidence, you know, that income inequality has grown quite a bit. Republicans, as Jack pointed out, they've been very resistant over time to these types of traditional Democratic solutions to poverty. They realize, just from a purely cynical, venal point of view, not many poor voters, not many poor people who do bother to vote are going to support Republicans. So they're in terms of poverty, they've had to try to show at least they're not terribly hard-hearted to get the more moderate vote. But this other issue is more problematic for Republicans, but also opens some opportunities that if they can show middle-class voters that they're the party for opportunity and to help close this inequality gap, that might be an opportunity for Republicans.
Let's go to one area, I think near or in, where one of these promise zones is aimed, President Obama's promise zone, Cherie in Barberville, Kentucky. Cherie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. And I also work for one of the federal TRIO programs that came out of the Lyndon Johnson speech 50 years ago. So this is very exciting.
What do you see coming with this promise zone? Are you in that area, Cherie? And what might it do for you?
We actually serve all those counties. So, yes, we are in that area.
And what would it mean? What's he suggesting here for you, for there, San Antonio? I don't have all the names in front of me right now, but what would it do for you?
Hopefully it's going to help us continue promote education better than what we have been doing in the past and thereby create new economic opportunities. We're stagnant around here. The best-paying jobs for high school teachers are working for one of the local colleges, and if it means that, and these jobs are stagnant, so we're turning out students who have nothing to do and can do nothing. So if it helps us bring in economic employment for these kids and these adults around here, I'm all for it.
Nothing to do and can do nothing. I can't think of a worse formula than that. Something needed there. Cherie, I really appreciate your call in Kentucky. One more here. Lauren in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is on a solution that I feel it would be great for poverty and as an issue for our whole country, not just promise zones, which might have some potential to work, but that is a guaranteed income or a guaranteed income program either at a state level or a federal level. I know it's being discussed right now in Switzerland, and there was a program, I believe, in the 70s in Canada. I think it was in Manitoba.
Lauren, I've heard that talked about, and it's very interesting, but I just wonder, with Cherie's words still ringing in my ears, you know, a lot of people there with nothing to do and can do nothing, where we have populations that, if they are like that, where's the money come from for guaranteed income?
Yeah, I agree. It would have to take some restructuring of our tax code, which needs to be done anyway, where if we simplified that and increased some taxes across the board, or for higher earners as well, where some more influx, more revenue could come in to cover that.
Guaranteed income. There's an idea out of Green Bay. Our time is short, Lauren, but I appreciate your call. Chuck Babington, we've got these new unemployment numbers out, 6.7. First time it's been down in that zone for a long time. Sounds great, but when you lift the lid on that and look at it, only 75,000 jobs created, like a third of what was expected. Are we getting into a zone where people are thinking in dramatically different ways? Lauren's suggesting that, or is it same old politics around the economy, Chuck, in Washington?
Well, first of all, Lauren's idea, I think, would have a terribly hard time getting through the Republican House. These employment numbers today were very, very disappointing. And we're back in this sort of this ongoing problem within Congress, within the government of a lot of smart people say you need more stimulus. If you really want to create jobs, there has to be more government activity, more spending, more stimulus. As you know, that has not been popular at all, and especially among Republicans and in the House. They've not only ended that, but keep insisting on deeper cuts. And you can make all kinds of good reasons why government should cut spending in certain ways. But the fact is, in terms of the economy, it has a non-stimulative effect on the economy. And there's a lot of independent economists who say the government is actually holding back what could be a more robust job growth.
Jack Beatty, stock market way high, but these numbers not good. Just when people thought they were about to click into the gears and take off.
Yes, and there was the Federal Reserve just about to grab the punch bowl back.
Yeah.
And this week, Janet Yellen approved, and probably a good thing from the point of view of keeping the recovery such as it is going, because she's been clearly the staunchest person there for a very accommodative monetary policy.
Margaret Brennan, our time is short, but I just have to ask you about the ever-outrageous Dennis Rodman. This week, maybe more outrageous than usual, singing happy birthday to Kim Jong-un in North Korea and blasting the American who's in prison there, Kenneth Bay. Is this just a clown show, sideshow, or is this a problem?
In short, it's a sideshow, yes, because it's not going to help Kenneth Bae get out of prison. He's the longest held American in North Korea since the Korean War itself. But it also emphasizes a sad statement about the state of diplomacy right now. I mean, these are the few windows we get into what's happening inside the Hermit Kingdom. And right now, it does not look like the U.S. is making any progress through the government to secure his release.
Well, he's apologized for going after Kenneth Bae. I don't know. There was always something kind of surreally amusing about Dennis Rodman. This week, I felt a little less convinced on the amusing part. But off he goes. Yeah. Margaret Brennan with CBS News. Terrific to have you here today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles Babington with the Associated Press in Washington. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, thanks to you, too. Thanks, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.